Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Leonard Leo, and on behalf of all of us at the Federalist Society, it is my privilege to welcome all of you to this year's annual convention. It is inspiring and exciting to see so many of you who have traveled so far to be here today, and whether you are from outside our nation's capital or not, it is a real testament to the strength of our movement for limited constitutional government that all of you would take time away from work and family to spend these next several days together. You know, it's hard to believe how the Federalist Society has flourished over the years. I remember not all that long ago, when we used to space out the chairs in this room to make the crowd seem bigger. Now we squeeze seats together as tightly as possible to accommodate an ever-growing community of citizen lawyers committed to the rule of law. The audience here today, in terms of its size and distinction and geographic reach, is representative of a flourishing movement of people that places a premium on the free exchange of ideas and on the structural limits on government power contained in the Constitution that are ultimately most important for the preservation of human dignity and freedom. The overall theme for these next several days is good government through agency, accountability, and transparency. The subject is right now at the intersection of the most important constitutional flashpoints we face today. Debate about the administrative state played an unprecedented part in the last two Supreme Court confirmations, and President Trump has stated that judicial selection is inextricably intertwined with this issue. We've witnessed over the past few years a growing number of lawsuits initiated by an historic number of states that challenge administrative action as a means of drawing clearer federalism boundaries. And at the heart of any current debate about repairing the legislative process is a serious inquiry into the proper limits of congressional delegation of power to administrative agencies. These and other issues will feature prominently in the programs you attend here. I know of no better person to launch this year's convention than U.S. Senator Mike Lee. Almost all of you, if not all of you, know him. He has been a mainstay at these gatherings. He has served in Federalist Society leadership, and as a senator, he has been an irrepressible advocate for ensuring respect for our structural Constitution. He is a man of tremendous principle and courage. He is a man who takes seriously his oath of office to preserve and defend our Constitution. He is sincere, candid, generous, and earnest. He is the kind of public servant our founding fathers envisioned. Please join me in welcoming Senator Mike Lee.
Thanks so much, Leonard. Thanks to all of you for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure and an honor to be at the Federalist Society in any form, but I especially like this annual gathering. I wanted to start today by telling you a story that I heard just a couple of days ago by a friend and neighbor of mine back in Utah. He told me about a nephew of his who's in medical school. His nephew's married. His nephew and his nephew's wife don't have any children, but they were the loving parents of a dog, a large dog, who tragically passed away recently. Well, his nephew was at medical school the day the dog passed away, and so his nephew's wife started to try to figure out what to do about the dog who had just tragically died. They lived in a small apartment in an urban area, and they didn't have a yard, so they didn't know where to bury the dog. They couldn't just take it outside and bury it anywhere, since they didn't have their own yard. So she called the vet and said, "What do I do?" The vet suggested at one point that she just bring the dog down to the vet's office, and the vet would arrange for disposal of the dog's body. Fair enough. Then she remembered, "Well, we don't have a car, so I'm going to have to take the subway to get to the vet. But this is a large dog. I don't really want to walk onto a subway train holding a large dead dog. That could be kind of awkward." So she did what any rational person would do in that circumstance. She got out a very large suitcase and put the large dead dog inside the very large suitcase. And she lugged the large heavy suitcase containing the large heavy dead dog onto the subway train. A chivalrous gentleman, seeing her carrying this very heavy suitcase, obviously not knowing what was inside, said, "May I help you with that, ma'am?" And she said, "Yes, please, thank you." He lifted it, and upon hefting this object, asked, "What on earth is in there? That's heavy." And she was too embarrassed to admit what it actually contained. And so she said, "Oh, it contains computer equipment." And so he went ahead and put it up on a shelf. When she got to her intended stop on the subway, she got out to lift this heavy suitcase off of the shelf, and lo and behold, the guy, it turns out, was still there. And he very chivalrously, again, got up and lifted the suitcase down. And she thought, "This man is so helpful, I'm glad he's here." But then something unexpected happened. The guy took off with the suitcase. I can't exactly count how many ways this is analogous to today's political environment. But there's definitely a close corollary to what the Democrats tried to do to Brett Kavanaugh. Now, Congress has just returned to Washington after a legislative recess of a few weeks during the election, at which time I'm sure Washington breathed a lot easier during that recess. But then we had the split results of this election that have caused a lot of people to panic. Everyone in the media, most people on Capitol Hill, and people within the administration are wondering all kinds of questions, like, you know, what's going to happen with the new Democratic House of Representatives? And will there be gridlock? There's all this hand-wringing going on. So I'm glad that at least one thing stays consistent, and that is that the Federalist Society continues to meet in Washington in November, shortly before Thanksgiving. At least we're still here. Now, I obviously had some disappointments on election night, a lot of them, in fact. Some good friends came up short in their races, and losing the Republican majority in the House of Representatives obviously hurts. It hurts a lot. But I'm not going to lie. I'm really, really going to like being able to call Mitt Romney the junior senator from Utah. That takes some of the sting out of it. Actually, but no one enjoys that more than Mitt Romney himself, who every time he speaks refers to himself as the junior senator from Utah. He tells me that at my age, I really like any term that comes with the word junior in it. It is those elections that we have just experienced and that are causing so much uncertainty in this town right now, and the ambiguous message that was sent through those elections that I'd like to talk about and think about a little bit today in my conversation with you. To constitutional conservatives, the election results and the split Congress that those election results will produce have to be seen as an opportunity to learn some lessons that both parties, especially my own party, have been ignoring for far too long. Now, obviously, I was strongly rooting for Republicans to win across the board Tuesday night. But from my perspective, divided government need not be a problem in and of itself. The House and Senate are going to be divided because the country itself is divided. In that sense, the election results again affirmed some of the genius of the Founding Fathers' framework. Now, in the media, division is often lamented and feared as if it were some sort of a disease that needs curing, ideally by conservatives just giving up and going along with whatever progressives want. A lot of them and a lot of people in Washington tend to view the job of the Republican as to just split the difference from our position and the goal and meet them half the distance to the goal. In other words, allowing progressives to continue to set the agenda and move us in their direction. All too often that happens. But disagreement especially in the United States, is not a disease. It's not something that we need to avoid just for the sake of avoiding it. It's a sign, actually, of health. Conflict, even an especially deep and bitter conflict, is innate, really, to all human relationships. And it's certainly in an innate part of any society and of any system of government in which the system calls itself a republic. Now, the Founding Fathers understood this. They had to, or they never would have gotten out of Philadelphia in one piece, much less with a document that would foster the development of the greatest civilization the world has ever known. From the day it was first conceived, the United States was among the most ideologically diverse nations in the world. Our Constitution was written specifically for a people divided on political, regional, cultural, and religious questions. It serves as a roadmap for resolving disputes peaceably through mechanisms designed to best facilitate the happiness and freedom and prosperity of its people, on all questions, really. When people ask today how Americans can overcome differences and come together as one nation, the answer remains today, in many, many respects, the same as it was back in 1787. You see, the Constitution system of separated powers and of federalism not only made the United States vibrant and flexible and resilient, but what the scholar Nassim Taleb calls anti-fragile. Ours is a system made stronger by tension and by division. Thanks to our Constitution, diversity really is a strength because of the common gratitude Americans can take from the freedom to govern their unique communities according to their own particular values. Under the alchemy of the Constitution, America's wild differences are transformed into a source of national unity. Now, each year for the last few years, I've tried to throw in a story about my daughter, Eliza. My daughter, Eliza, is now 17 years old. She's a senior at Lone Peak High School in Highland, Utah, near our home in Alpine, Utah. And she often says things that are sometimes unintentionally profound, sometimes just profound in and of themselves. Eliza recently had her wisdom teeth removed. And as she was coming out of anesthesia, well, heavily sedated, the oral surgeon brought my wife and me into the operating room to help her recover. And as she was coming out of the anesthesia, she sat there. It turns out she would be a happy drunk, a nice drunk, a loving drunk. I love you, man. She was sitting there saying, Mom and Dad, I love you. You're just the best parents in the world. You're so nice. And then she paused and she looked over at me and she said, and I love federalism and I love separation of powers. The oral surgeon, knowing me as he does, looked over at me and he said, that must be your proudest moment. Yeah. And indeed it was. Today, though, it doesn't always seem like division is, in fact, our greatest source of strength, even though it can be, even though it should be, even though it, in fact, is under our constitutional system. Today, our disagreements sometimes seem to be pulling us apart and not together, but it doesn't have to be that way. Take, for example, the character assassination of Brett Kavanaugh, or, excuse me, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Six weeks after he was confirmed, I still can't completely get my head around what happened. My Democratic colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee deliberately withheld material evidence from committee and FBI investigators for weeks so as to maximize the cruelty visited upon Justice Kavanaugh, visited upon Justice Kavanaugh's family, visited upon Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. They used a nationally televised hearing to ask Justice Kavanaugh about such weighty matters as flatulence and drinking games. They attempted to launder vile accusations raised by Michael Avenatti, and they uncritically repeated other unsubstantiated, uncorroborated, specious allegations. They justified their stunning, bold, and deliberately cruel abandonment of the presumption of innocence by saying blithely that the confirmation process was merely a job interview, as if that somehow disposed of any kind of a need for fairness or kindness or decency. The truth is that Democrats were acting irresponsibly even before Dr. Ford's letter was leaked to the press. My friend, the junior senator from New Jersey, declared that Justice Kavanaugh's supporters were quote-unquote complicit in evil and urged protesters to get up in the face of congresspeople. Now, we're told that this is somehow payback for Judge Merrick Garland's nomination and what happened there. At least Brett Kavanaugh had a hearing, the left would tell us, as if that would somehow justify a deliberate effort to destroy a man's life. And in any event, that excuse can in no way, shape, or form justify or explain the smears against the other highly qualified nominees, those possessing exemplary character that we've seen over the last few decades. So while the Democrats' treatment of Justice Kavanaugh is perhaps the worst and the most recent, the most current manifestation of this phenomenon, while it was shocking and disgusting, let's be honest, it was neither completely unprecedented nor entirely surprising given what we've seen from them in the past few decades. In any event, we need to find a way to prevent things like this from happening again, ever. I applaud Chairman Grassley for investigating every lead and making criminal referrals where appropriate. That's one very important way to deter people from making false accusations like these and engaging in this awful pattern of conduct. But there's an even deeper problem, I think. From the perspective of raging extremists who control the left's agenda, what happened earlier this year, as evil as it was entirely rational, as they see it. For decades, we have pulled powers constitutionally reserved for the states and for the people into the federal government. And then once they're here, we have transferred those from the people's elected lawmakers over to unaccountable, unelected bureaucrats, over to the administrative state. Today, more and more decisions are made in Washington rather than in city halls and state capitals. And more of Washington's decisions are made by unelected judges and unaccountable bureaucrats, not senators and representatives as they're supposed to be. This anti-constitutional project has hacked away at the bonds of trust formed long ago between the American people and their government by seizing power from more politically homogeneous local governments and communities. Washington denies the American people the ability to govern by consensus. A government designed to be by the people, of the people, and for the people, all people, is too often instead run for 51% of the United States and against the other 49%. This approach artificially raises the stakes of federal policymaking and therefore raises the temperature of our national political discourse to an unacceptable degree. As long as Supreme Court justices anoint themselves as philosopher kings, issuing moral decrees, to use Nancy Pelosi's words, almost as if God has spoken, how is not that not blasphemy, but anyway, the total political war we saw this fall is gonna continue as long as that continues to be our mindset. Because that's what happens when you raise the political stakes and the political temperature to the degree that we have in recent decades by concentrating this much power as we have. As long as the federal government blithely asserts the power to regulate, to penalize, to tax, or to subsidize any and all behavior, our politics will incite the very impulses that constitutions were written specifically to overcome. When we saw that leftist mob just a few blocks from here driving Ted Cruz and his wife from a restaurant while they were just out on a nice date together one evening, or violent criminals terrorizing Tucker Carlson's poor wife at her own home. This is just the beginning. Increasingly, the left treats politics like a religion, and conservatives not as loyal opponents, but as heretics and infidels. On college campuses and other institutions where the left holds unchallenged power, the right is not questioned, but anathematized. Conservative arguments are denounced as hate speech, as illegitimate, as undeserving, somehow, of First Amendment protection. Many students today are being taught the foolish theory that some speech is violence, and by extension, the evil corollary that some violence is speech. The popularity on the right of a more combative style is only further evidence that Americans have simply accepted the unhappy consequences of Washington's bipartisan consensus that all politics is now necessarily, unavoidably national. As we've seen in recent elections, very much including last week's midterms, our growing ideological divide mirrors a hardening geographic divide. Look at any electoral map today, and you'll see the same thing. America is split in two. Democrats are increasingly clustering in densely populated cities and in and near suburbs, mostly on the coast. Republicans are winning in exurban and in rural America. After last week's elections, for the first time in a century, only one state in the Union will have a divided legislature. Red and blue America see the country and see the world very, very differently. So differently, in fact, that our rhetoric today seems often to be less about option A versus option B, or even about correct versus incorrect, or ideal versus suboptimal, and more in the realm of good versus evil. Such stridency makes moral consensus rare and makes federal compromise very, very difficult. Taken together, these three trends, bitter philosophical disagreement, stark geographic division, and the bipartisan embrace of winner-take-all, necessarily national politics. Compromise has become a sort of constitutional crisis. In other words, these things taken together make up a constitutional dirty bomb that threatens the foundations of our republic. Terms like bitter clingers or deplorables, the Kavanaugh nomination, the religious inquisition of Amy Comey Barrett and of Russ Vogt, even worse, Charlottesville and the congressional baseball practice. Even the institutions set up to shield Americans from the sort of mob behavior that's always threatened the stability of republics are coming today increasingly under attack. The Electoral College, the legislative filibuster, even the Senate itself, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the presumption of innocence, the right to bear arms, in today's all-or-nothing national politics, especially on the left, but sometimes also on the right, these bulwarks of liberty are too often, too casually, dismissed as obstacles of progress. Meanwhile, proponents of these principles are not just dismissed, but they're often downright vilified and cast out as some sort of demons. This toxicity of our national politics and revolt against our institutions is itself the fruit, the inevitable, foreseeable fruit of centralized power. This is what centralized power does, and we therefore shouldn't be surprised when this comes about as a result of many decades of power centralization in Washington, D.C. Centralization, you see, has not made us stronger. It has not made us happier. It has not made our economy stronger or more dynamic or more likely to promote economic mobility among the poor and middle class, which, by the way, has always been one of the distinguishing features of our economy. Sure, there are lots of countries where some people are prosperous. America has been relatively unique in that this is a land where you can be born into poverty and have the reasonable hope and expectation that if you work hard and play by the rules, one day you'll be able to retire comfortably. Centralization tends to produce the exact opposite of these very things that we have come to identify so closely with who we are as a nation. Meanwhile, and for many of the same reasons, it's making our politics weak and coarse and raw and brittle. Where do we think this is going to take us next? If and when the opportunity comes to replace one of the Supreme Court's liberals. In 2020, as Democrats jockey to see which one can be their successful Trump candidate, where's it going to take us? Bear in mind, we're at this fever pitch emotionally and in our rhetoric at a time of relative peace and economic prosperity within our country. Thanks in large measure to President Trump's economic reforms and the sense of optimism that those reforms have created within our economy. Our economy is at full employment, and it's growing fast enough to distract us, at least temporarily, from our $21 trillion national debt and our $800 billion annual deficit. Perhaps it shouldn't be enough, but for the time being, it is. But my big concern is, what happens when the next bubble bursts? When the next recession hits? When the multi-trillion dollar debts accrued by state and local pension funds come due? What happens when next we face a genuine international crisis? What happens when Treasury yield rates return to their historic average and we see our national debt service payments go from where they are today, which is about $300 billion a year, which is not that much higher than they were 20 years ago when our national debt was, what, 1/7 of its current size? To where they'll go within a couple of years after Treasury yield rates return to their historical average, which will be around $1 trillion a year, forcing us to find another roughly $700 billion per year in federal revenue, more than our entire budget for the Department of Defense within a surprisingly short period of time. What happens then? You get the idea. According to any reasonable measuring stick, the dysfunctional status quo is unsustainable, even in good times like those we're experiencing right now. It's driving our government toward insolvency and our politics toward violence. Realistically, Americans have two options. Either we're going to once again embrace the Constitution's vision of a diverse, tolerant, pluralistic union of states and of communities, each governed according to the values and priorities.